Let's turn to Deuteronomy chapter 19 as we continue our study through the Bible. In the 19th chapter, the first thing that Moses is dealing with is when they come into the land and they possess the land that God is giving to them, the establishing of these three cities of refuge that were to be a sanctuary for the person who accidentally killed someone else. In that culture, and still today, in the Bedouin culture of the Middle East, if someone kills one of your family members, you become honor-bound to kill them. I mean, it's your duty, you're honor-bound to do it, to avenge the blood of the family member that was slain. Now, because this was a part of the culture and the customs of the people, injustices were wrought because oftentimes when if you killed someone, it was by accident. And Moses gives an example here of what we would call manslaughter. You're going out into the woods with your friend to cut down some trees. And as you're swinging your axe, the axe head flies off and hits the guy and it kills him. Now, he was your friend. You didn't intend to kill him. It wasn't with malice. It wasn't something premeditated. It was just a pure accident. And so in order that you might be protected from vengeance by the family member of that other person, within the center of the land, more or less, that is in centralized locations, there were to be established these cities of refuge where you could flee and be protected within the gates of that city so that the avenger of blood could not pursue you within the city to take vengeance upon you for the accidental killing of the member of his family. These cities were to be strategically located so that you could get there quickly. And also, the roads to these cities were to be well maintained and well marked. At each crossroad, there was the sign that said, "Refuge, refuge," with the arrow pointing towards the direction you wanted to go to get to that city of refuge. And it was a protection so that a person who was guilty of manslaughter would not be slain, because that would then be the shedding of innocent blood, inasmuch as there was no premeditation or malice involved in the death of the other person. Now, on the side of the Jordan where they had already established, there were already three cities of refuge over there. Now when they move into the land and you take further territory. Now, Moses then also said, if you do expand even further your territory, you remember that God promised to give to Abraham all the territory from the Nile River to the Euphrates. They never did take all of the land that God had promised. Now, should it be that you obey the Lord and God blesses you and your territory expands, then with the expansion of the territory was to be the expansion of the number of the cities of refuge so that there would always be a place of refuge within reach. Of course, people see within the city of refuge, a beautiful type of Jesus Christ, where we have fled for refuge, where we are safe. A person who fled to a city of refuge would be safe. as long as he remained in that city of refuge. And so people see that as a type of Jesus Christ where we for refuge have fled. Now, if a person was guilty of first-degree murder, there was premeditation, he was lying in wait to ambush him, hatred and malice were involved, then there was no refuge for that person, even in the city of refuge. When the avenger of blood came to the city, the elders of the city of refuge would have to turn over such a man to the avenger of blood that he might be slain. No place of refuge for that presumptuous kind of sin. A man who hates his neighbor, lies in wait, rises against him and strikes him mortally so that he dies. No place of refuge for him. Your eye shall not pity him, verse 13, but you shall put away the guilt of innocent blood from Israel that it might go well with you. The purpose of justice is the preservation of your society, that it might go well with you. Next, Moses deals very briefly with the removing of your neighbor's landmark, which men of old had set. Now, when they came into the land was first of all to be divided to the tribes. And then that portion that was given to the tribe was to be divided to the families within the tribe so that each family received their portion of land. And they would set up these rock markers. And even to the present day, over in the land, you can see these little rock markers. They don't have, you know, modern surveying methods, and they don't drive down these stakes, you know, and put the little marker on it, the surveyor's marker. They don't do that. What they do is just put up a pile of stones. And that stone pile is the marker of the boundary of the land. And that becomes a very sacred thing. You're not to move those stones, you know, go out at night and move it over a foot or a yard or so, you know, to expand your yard into your neighbor's yard. They were held very sacred, the markers for the property boundaries. And so the law against the moving of your neighbor's landmark, which have been set. Then the law concerning witnesses. You could not invoke capital punishment against a person in the mouth of one witness. You had to have at least two or three witnesses to establish the veracity or the truth of a matter. And if a man should rise up and bear false witness against another man, testifying that he did something wrong, and there develops this argument. The guy says, no, I'm innocent. He said, no, I saw him do it. I saw him do it. And he is testifying falsely against the man. There's to be a very serious examination of the facts by the priest. And if it is found that you're just trying to get me in trouble, you're angry with me, and you're trying to get me thrown in jail, or you're trying to get me stoned, the penalty for what you're accusing me of will be given to you, because you were bearing false witness against me and trying to get me to be punished some way. The very punishment that would be meted out were I guilty is meted out upon you because you have borne false witness against me. Now, verse 20, it declares that that person who does that is to be put away, the evil person, from among you, that those who remain shall hear and fear and hereafter they shall not again commit such evil among you. The purpose of the severity of the penalties were intended as a deterrent to crime. Now, our social scientists today say that severe penalties are not deterrents to crime. But that's all hypothetical speculation on the part of the social scientists. They don't have any proof to that. In fact, proof seems to be otherwise. Big flap last week because a couple of men were hanged in Malaysia who were caught with drugs. But I noticed that in the British papers, and they were quite into that because one of them had joint British and Australian citizenship. And you know, some of those British tabloids, they have headlines that are half the size of the front page. And they made a big deal over the hanging of these two men on drug charges in Malaysia. But I noticed that the paper said that this will surely serve notice to anyone who is carrying drugs to steer far from Malaysia. Because even Margaret Thatcher made a plea to the government over there to commute the sentences and so forth and for leniency, but they showed no leniency. They went ahead and hanged these two fellows in spite of all of the hullabaloo that was raised up over the thing. But it makes you think twice before you, when you book your routing on your airlines, if you're carrying drugs in your suitcase, man, you think twice before you go through Malaysia. Because you know that these people mean business when they say that they don't want any drug trafficking in their country. And these two fellows are only two of many. The only reason why there was so much press about it is because one did have joint Australian British citizenship. But some 32 have been hanged in the last couple of years in Malaysia over drug charges. And word gets out, hey, steer clear of Malaysia. Of course, it's even more so in Singapore. There they don't even spend 2 years trying you in court. If you're caught with drugs, the policeman takes his 45 and blows your head off. So Singapore has absolutely no drug problem. It is a deterrent. And these social sob sisters who are constantly calling for a greater leniency and the resocialization, etc., 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 declaring that the severe penalties really don't have a deterrent against crime. They're wrong. The Bible declares that it does. Those who remain shall hear and fear, and hereafter they shall not again commit such evil among you. All you have to do is start invoking the penalties of the law, and you'll find out that people will think twice before they commit a crime. Your eye, he said, shall not pity. You're not to get soft. But a life shall be for life, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, a hand for a hand, and a foot for a foot. Now, you say, but Jesus said, you've heard it hath been said by those of old times, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, but I say unto you. Now, Jesus, notice, said, you have heard that it hath been said. At the time that Jesus was teaching, the people, except for the scholars, did not know the Hebrew language, and thus they could not read their own scriptures. They were dependent upon the scribes to teach them the law of God. And as the scribes taught the law of God, there was a lot of interpretation of the law. And Jesus was constantly coming out against the way they interpreted the law, showing the inconsistencies in their interpretations. Now, as they interpreted this law, an eye for an eye, tooth for tooth, and so forth, they had interpreted it as a mandatory obligation in a personal way. And people liked that interpretation because people like revenge. There's something within me, an evil perversity of my nature, that I love to get even. And I like that idea, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. I mean, it appeals to my perverse nature. But reading in context, it's not something that is to be enacted by me on a personal basis, but it is the judgment in the hands of the judges and how they are to deal with the situation, and it doesn't really apply to me taking personal vengeance against a person. And that's the way it had been interpreted to them, and that's why Jesus said, "You've heard it that hath been said. You know, someone blacks your eye, black his eye. Breaks your nose, break his nose. Knocks out a tooth, knock out his tooth." Personal revenge. No, that's not what the law said. The law is dealing with how the judges are to deal with the matters. And it isn't a matter of personal vengeance as it had been interpreted. And that's the difference when you get into the New Testament, what Jesus was talking about. Now, chapter 20 deals with the laws concerning warfare. When you go out against your enemies, you see their horses and their chariots, and you realize you're outnumbered. What are you going to do? Remember who's with you. When you're faced with a situation that's bigger than you, when you realize that you personally can't cope, then what you need to do is turn to one who is greater than you, stronger than you, and realize that he is with you to help you. So do not be afraid of them, for the Lord your God is with you, who brought you up from the land of Egypt. How important that we remember and we constantly realize that greater is he that is in us than he that is in the world. When David came out against the Philistine giant, and he was disturbed that they would send a child out against him. "Don't you have any men? Am I a dog? You'd send this little kid out here to fight me?" And turning to David, he sought to intimidate him. "Little boy, you better go home right now, or I'll cut you up and feed you to the birds." And David responded, "You've come at me with a sword and a spear, but I come against you in the name of the living God that you have defied." David knew who was with him. David had no fear. He knew that God, who delivered them out of Egypt, was with him in the battle against the giant. When you go into battle, when you're faced with a situation, you're outnumbered, you realize you can't do it yourself. Remember, the Lord is with you. Don't be afraid. The Lord is with you. Now, when you come to the verge of the battle, the priest is to go out and speak to the army. Now, the priest evidently went to battle with them. In fact, in the time of David, the priest was with them, and they would inquire of the priest, "Shall we attack now? From which direction shall we attack?" And the Lord would actually direct their battle plans. But when you're on the verge of the battle, the priest to go out and he is to say, first of all, words of encouragement. Now, don't let your heart be faint. Don't be afraid. Don't tremble or be terrified because of the enemies. For the Lord your God is he who goes with you to fight for you against your enemies to save you. So the priest was to give them a little word of encouragement, reminding them that God was with them. And then, any of you fellas build a new house? You haven't moved in yet? Go on home. See, in the battle, you might be thinking about that new house and, you know, man, I've got to finish the kitchen, you know, and you're not really concentrating on the battle. And so those that had built a new house, hadn't moved in, they could go home. Have you planted a vineyard and you haven't eaten thereof yet? You haven't, you know, you've gone all the trouble, you've planted the vineyard and everything else, but yet you haven't yet gathered any fruit from it. Go on home. Are you betrothed to a wife, but you're not married yet? You're engaged, but not married. On home. That betrothed and yet not married is interesting because that was the situation, you remember, of Mary and Joseph. She was espoused to Joseph when she became pregnant by the work of the Holy Spirit. So that this betrothal or espousal period, as we will get into the next, in a couple chapters, it's equivalent scripturally to being married. In fact, if you were engaged under those terms and those in that culture, you would have to get a divorce. Even though you weren't yet married, you had to get a divorce even from this business of betrothal or espousal. Of course, it used to be that we were a little more severe even in this country. You could sue for breach of promise. And they don't do that anymore. You know, you can ask a dozen gals to marry you and get the promises and so forth, but there's no more suit for breach of promise as far as he promised he was going to marry me or she promised he was going to marry me. But in that culture, they took the engagement much more seriously, and you were considered as married, though the marriage was not yet consummated. So you're betrothed to a woman. You've not yet married her. You're dismissed from battle. Having gotten rid of those people whose minds would probably be on other things rather than the battle itself, the priest next said, who is fearful and faint-hearted? Go on home. Now, the reason for that is that being fearful, they might panic in the midst of the battle and create fear among the other troops. Fear is a contagious thing. And so, lest they panic in the midst of the battle, they were sent home, those who were afraid to go into the battle. You remember when Gideon gathered together his army to face the Midianites. There were some 32,000 that responded to Gideon's call. And so the Lord said to Gideon, the men that are with you are too many, even though the Midianites had 135,000. I know the hearts of these people. If I deliver the Midianites into their hands, they'll go around glorying in what they have done. So go out and tell all of those who are afraid to fight to go home. Gideon's 32,000 diminished immediately down to 10,000. So of the 32,000, 22,000 were afraid. I don't blame them. They were outnumbered pretty thoroughly even at that point. But the priest was to say, if you're afraid, if you're faint-hearted, go ahead and leave. After you've gotten the thing thinned down, now appoint the captains to lead you into battle. Now, when you come near a city to fight against it, first of all, offer that city peace. That is, to surrender. And if they surrender, then they become your slaves. You take tribute from them. If they don't surrender, then you lay siege against the city. And when God delivers the city in your hand, you're to kill all of the males, but save the women alive and their little children and the livestock. And that becomes your spoil and your plunder. That was true of the cities that were outside of their boundaries, but those cities that they were to conquer within the land that God had promised, they were not to spare anyone. Nothing that breathes. Everything is to be utterly wiped out. Verse 16, but the cities of those people which the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance, nothing that breathes shall remain alive. Utterly destroy them, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, and the Hivites, and the Jebusites. Now, God was using the children of Israel as his tool of judgment against these wicked nations. These people were involved in practices that were so horribly vile. So horribly degrading that God in his judgment had ordered their extermination. Now, not of all people, but of these particular people who were living in the land, it was because of their horrible wickedness that God was driving them out and giving the land to the children of Israel. And so for them, there was to be no mercy, nothing spared. You're to utterly destroy them, everything that breathes, because you are God's tool of judgment against these nations for the vile things that they have done. Also, if anything remains alive, or if you allow them to remain alive, there is that chance of your being polluted by their very activities, and the things that brought their destruction will then bring your destruction. There are paths that nations can take that are self-destructive. And those paths that nations take that are self-destructive are paths after the flesh. And sad to say, the United States is on that path. And there are many who are seeking to promote the U.S. on that path. It is my opinion that the American Civil Liberties Union has done more to destroy the United States than any foreign country. Breaking down the moral fibers that made us strong. Opening the doors for all kinds of filth and pornography to be disseminated across our nation. The suits that they have filed have opened the doors as brilliant men, so brilliant that they sit on the Supreme Court, yet they haven't the capacity to discern what is obscene and not obscene, what is dirty and not dirty. Little fifth grade kids can tell you what's a dirty picture and not a dirty picture, but unfortunately, those men on the Supreme Court seem to be unable to do so. But by this, we are entering into that path of the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Perizzites, the path that brings destruction. Righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. Our nation is tremendously weakened morally. And that is extremely dangerous. As Gibbons recounts the rise and the fall of the Roman Empire, he very clearly points out that Rome was really not conquered from without, but destroyed from within. And of course, he goes into a lot of those things that were being done, the excesses, fleshly excesses within the Roman Empire, that the moral rottenness that decayed the very pillars of the Roman Empire, and thus it fell from within rather than really being conquered from without. One of the reasons why we had such great difficulties in Vietnam was the widespread use of drugs and alcohol among our troops. We don't like to admit that. We want to think that we're a Christian nation and we were fighting a bunch of heathens. How we need to become strong again. There are things that can destroy a nation from within. And thus, lest they become infected by the activities of these people who were so vile that God had to destroy them and used the nation of Israel as his instrument of judgment, they were to be complete in their extermination, not leaving them to pollute God's people. Verse 18, lest they teach you to do according to all of their abominations which they have done for their gods, and you sin against the Lord your God. Now, an interesting thing, if you are set siege against a city, you start building your weapons to scale the walls or to batter the gates or whatever. When you cut down trees to make your battering rams and all, don't use trees that bear fruit that can be eaten. They're your sustenance. So use only trees that don't produce any food. You know, use the sycamore or the oak or some tree that doesn't have fruit. Don't cut down the fruit trees. I like that. I love fruit, and so good law. Now, if a man was found dead out in the field, and no one knows who killed him, the priests are to come and they are to carefully measure the distance to each of the cities from this open territory where the man's body was found. And the city which is closest to this man, to the carcass, the elders of that city are to take a heifer, and they're to go down into a valley where there is a running stream, and they're to break the neck of the heifer, and they're to wash their hands in that stream, the running water, and they are to swear that they did not kill the man, nor do they know who killed the man. And by this, they were expunged from the guilt. And so this is the method by which they dealt with the unsolved crime. We don't know who did it. We swear we don't. We didn't do it. We don't know who did. And the death of that heifer then would serve as the substitute for the actual guilty party, whoever they were. And thus, they were providing atonement, verse 8, for the people Israel, which God had redeemed, and not to lay innocent blood to the charge of your people Israel. So the heifer was killed as a substitute. Now, in verse 10, if you've captured an enemy city and you see a beautiful gal, And of course, this doesn't apply to the inhabitants of the land that they were taking. But again, when you're going out to battle, you take a city and you see a beautiful gal. You think you're in love with her. You desire her. You'd like to have her as your wife. Then you're to bring her home to your house, and she shall shave her head and trim her nails. And then you take another look. She is to remain in your house for 30 days as she has the opportunity of mourning over her family that was lost in battle, because you're to kill the males and the females were to be taken as captives. They were to be really used as slaves in those days. But there's one you want to marry. You think, oh, she's pretty, I'd like to marry her. You bring her home, give her 30 days to grieve over her lost household. And then you may take her as your wife. But if you've decided then, I don't want her. During that 30 days, you've seen traits and characteristics that sort of make her undesirable. She whines a lot, or then you're to set her free. You know, you've actually humiliated her in shaving her head and cutting her nails. So you're to set her free. You're not to sell her. You can't sell her now as a slave. But she is entitled to freedom. But you don't have to marry her after 30 days. You see that you don't want her. You don't have to marry her. Set her free. Don't sell her for money. You shall not treat her brutally, because you've actually humiliated her in the shaving of her head and all. Now, if a man has two wives, and polygamy was practiced in those days, but I can see problems with polygamy. I can see advantages too, as far as that goes. I mean, if you want to... You have one that's a good cook, one that's a good look. Send a couple out to work to bring the money in, and I mean, you could live like a king, you know. But I think the disadvantages outweigh the advantages. There would no doubt, as Jacob, you remember, with Leah and Rachel. He loved Rachel much more than Leah. And I'm sure that would create some real problems. And this case, if a man has two wives, he loves one more than the other, but the one he doesn't care so much about bears his first son. When the time comes to give the inheritance, he is not to give it to the son of the wife that he loves more, if he is the second son. But the firstborn son, regardless of his attachments or feelings towards the mothers, the firstborn son has the right of inheritance, and he gets a double portion of the inheritance because he's the beginning of the strength. And so the children aren't to suffer because of the father's inconsistency here. Verse 18 deals with rebellious sons. If you have a son who is stubborn, he's rebellious, he will not obey his parents, even after they have spanked him, chastened him, he still doesn't give heed. Then his father and mother shall take hold of him and bring him to the elders of the city and to the gate of the city and say to the elders, this son of ours is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey us. He's a glutton and he's a drunkard. Then all the men of the city will stone him to death with stones. Pretty tough. Pretty tough. But the purpose is to get rid of that evil person out of your society, plus putting fear in the hearts of other boys who think that they might want to rebel against the authority of their parents. All Israel shall hear and fear. Now, if a man has committed a crime that is a capital offense and he's put to death by hanging, they're not to let him hang overnight. They are to give him a quick and immediate burial. Hanging overnight from the tree would defile the land. And so an immediate burial is to be given to him, not to defile the land which God has given. For he who is hanged is accursed of God. Paul picks this up in Galatians, the third chapter, inasmuch as Jesus was hanged on a tree, crucified. You see, the curse of the law, or the man hanged on a tree, is cursed of God. So there is the curse of the law. And he who, so Paul said in Galatians, the third chapter, Christ has redeemed us from the curse of the law, being made a curse for us. For it is written, cursed is every man that hangeth on a tree. So by Jesus' crucifixion, cursed of God, the curse of the law was upon him, death by hanging on a tree, or death by crucifixion. So that by his death, in our place, he has redeemed us from the penalty of death, becoming a curse for us. And so that glorious truth of the substitutionary death of Christ in our place. Chapter 22. Neighborliness. If you see your brother's ox or his sheep going astray, you're not to hide yourself from it. One of the problems of our society today is people just don't want to get involved. We're constantly shocked by the stories of people who have been assaulted and how people just stood by, did nothing to help them, didn't want to interfere. Women being raped in public, and the crowd just standing, no one doing anything to stop it, no one wanting to interfere. It's a rather rough place to live when people don't want to get involved to help someone who is in need. And so to protect Israel against that kind of calloused attitude, God gave laws. You see, an ox or a sheep that's gone astray, it's lost. You're not to just go in your house and close the door and say, well, what a shame, you know, someone's lost their ox. Or my neighbor's sheep have strayed off, too bad, you know, and just close the door and go to bed. But you shall certainly bring them back to your brother. You're to get involved. Now, if he lives too far, or you don't know whose ox or sheep it is, but you obviously it's straight off, then you're to take it and you're to keep it yourself. Put it in your own stall and keep it until the owner comes looking for it. And then when he comes looking for it, you're to return and restore to him. And thus shall it be for any lost thing. In other words, it wasn't losers, weepers, finders, keepers. But there was that obligation of seeking to find whoever owned that property that, you know, that you had found. Find the owner and restore and give it back to the owner. Now, if you see your brother's ox or donkey fall in a ditch, and you see him trying to get the thing out of the ditch, you're to go over and help him. Now, you say, well, that doesn't apply to our society. You know, I don't have any ox or, you know, donkeys falling in ditches around here. Okay, you want a modern version? You see your brother who has a dead battery pushing his car, trying to get it started. Get out and help him push. Don't honk your horn and say, get out of the way, you know. Be neighborly. Go out of your way to help someone in need is basically what the scripture is teaching us. Don't be selfish. Don't be just all locked into yourself. Help those who are in need. Next, a woman is not to wear clothing that belongs to a man. And of course, this is subject to interpretation for sure. Basically, you know, in those days, men wore robes. So what can you say? Basically, if you look at the law, what is he really seeking to prohibit? Men trying to look like women. And women trying to look like men. When we arrived in London last Saturday week, our hotel was right next to Hyde Park. And it so happened on that particular Saturday that they were having in Hyde Park a big gay demonstration. And they had, I guess, a parade because parked along the street were some floats with these fruits. That were dressed and made up like women. I mean, in looking at them, you'd think that they were women. But the signs were proclaiming otherwise. We had our little 5-year-old granddaughter. And my heart was sick for her to see that kind of junk that you usually associate with West Los Angeles and San Francisco. No, it really troubled me that my little granddaughter, 5 years old, in all of her beauty and innocence, would have to be exposed to these fellows who have a problem, trying to look like women, dressing like women. In the same token, women were not to seek to appear as men. And that's basically the prohibition here. It isn't, you know, you women aren't to wear Levi's. I wouldn't wear the kind of Levi's you wore for all the money in the mint. I mean, you have a right to those kind of Levi's if you want them, and I have no problem with that. Or Jordache or whatever they are. A lot of people, you know, they really get strung out on this. It's just basically, don't try to look like a woman if you're a man, and don't try to look like a man if you're a woman. Because that, it says, is an abomination to the Lord your God. If he wanted you to be a woman, he would have created you a woman. It's an abomination to God. Now, if you're out hunting, you come upon a bird's nest, you want the eggs, or the little birds, don't take the mother. Let her go free. Take the nest, or the eggs, or the little ones, but don't take the mother. Let the mother go, that she might have more eggs and more little birds. When you build a new house, you're to put a railing around the roof so that no one falls off accidentally. They had flat roofs on their houses, and they always had a stairway up to the roof. And you did, that was your patio in their houses over there. That's your patio on the roof. You'll see women over there hanging their clothes out on the roof. They have their clotheslines out on the roofs of their houses. You see women scrubbing with a mop and pail their roofs. It's part of the living quarters over there. Now, if you just had the straight flat roof and no protection around it, it'd be easy for people to just fall off the roof. So when you build your houses, put a protection around the roof. Build up the walls around the roof, railings, banisters, or whatever, so that people won't be falling off the parapet or the balustrade, a banister, so that, you know, someone doesn't get hurt. So it's just plain common sense. Now, this diversity is interesting. You're not to sow your vineyard with different kinds of seed, lest the vineyard be defiled. You're not to plow with an ox or a donkey together. You're not to yoke them together. It's an uneven or an unequal yoke. You're not to wear a garment of different sorts of materials, such as a combination of wool and linen mixed together. Now, it is interesting, in the mixing of wool and linen together, it does create an electrostatic kind of a thing that will make you extremely irritated. And this is true of a lot of the synthetic fabrics that we have today. They have discovered with the airline pilots that sitting on the synthetic fabrics actually tires them and on the long hauls. And so they've gone now, in the most part, to these wool, all wool kind of sheepskin seats and so forth, because it isn't nearly as irritating. It doesn't set up that electrostatic kind of thing on your body where, you know, your skin begins to crawl and And synthetic fibers or mixed fibers can do that. And that could be one of the reasons why God told them not to do it. You are to make these tassels on the corners of your robes. Now, these little tassels were to have a blue thread in it. And the robes, evidently, as they threw them over themselves or wrapped them around, there were four corners. And on each of the corners, this little tassel with a blue thread, and it was really to remind them of God. You remember in the New Testament when Jesus was walking with the ruler Jairus, the ruler of the synagogue, walking to his house because his little daughter was deathly ill, that a woman came out of the crowd and touched the hem of his garment. That hem there is the tassel of his garment. This little tassel that was required here, make four tassels. She grabbed one of those little tassels on the garment of Jesus. And so he turned around and said, "Who touched me?" And that's when Peter said, "Lord, you got to be kidding. You know, people are pushing you and shoving all around here. What do you mean, who touched me?" But she had grabbed or touched the tassel on his garment, the hem, the tassel. Now, if a man takes a wife, and after he has gone in, consummated the marriage, and then he discovers that he hates her, and you remember this happened in David's household, And of course, here's one of the problems of the multiplicity of wives. One of his sons fell in love with his half-sister. Desired her. Couldn't eat. Couldn't sleep. He had such a tremendous desire for her, Ammon. This desire for his half-sister. And so he finally grabbed her and forced her. And then immediately he hated her. Sought to shove her aside. Absalom, of course, took revenge and killed him. But you'll get that as we move along and we get into the story of David. David's household. But sometimes that was the case. A man, you know, driven by his passions, thinks, I love her, I want her, I've got to have her. And then once he's consummated the marriage, no longer wants her. Now, if this man in this situation starts spreading a dirty rumor saying, well, she wasn't a virgin. I married her. I thought she was pure, but she wasn't pure. She wasn't a virgin. Trying to get out of the marriage. You see, if a man puts away his wife, except it be for fornication, and marries another, he commits adultery. Well, he's trying to get out of it, saying, well, she found out she wasn't a virgin when I married her, so. Then her parents are to bring the signs of her virginity. And that, of course, was the bedclothes from the bed at the time that they had had the consummation of the marriage, proving that she was a virgin. And this man who made this false accusation against this girl who was pure was to be beaten, fined 100 shekels of silver, which were given to her parents, and he could not divorce her ever. Of course, that seems to me that it would be rather hard on the woman. It seems to me that there should have been an out for her. I mean, a guy doesn't like her, just forget him. But women really didn't have much as far as rights in those days. Now, if it was proved that she was not a virgin, or if they could not prove that she was a virgin, then she would be stoned to death. So it was rather severe, but rather hard. If a man is found lying with a woman that is married to another man, adultery, then they are both to be put to death. If there is a young gal who is a virgin and yet she's engaged to be married, some fellow rapes her if it's in the city, then they are both to be put to death because she didn't cry out. She was a party to it, and thus they were both. And you see, looking at the engagement period as though she was already married. If it happened out in a field, then just the fellow was put to death because though she had cried, there was no one to hear her or to help her. If a young man finds a young woman who is a virgin and who is not betrothed, he seizes her and lies with her, and they are found out, then the man who lay with her shall give to the young woman's father 50 shekels of silver. He has to marry her, and there can be no divorce. He can never put her away all of her days. And then finally, incest is prohibited in verse 30. So, some of the laws pertaining to the people prior to their coming into the land, whereby they are to develop a society that is pure, that is strong, that is free from those evils that deteriorate and destroy a society. God wanted the preservation. And thus the laws are to preserve that which is good. And the purpose of the laws are the preservation of a society. And when the laws break down, anarchy ensues. Everyone does that which is right in his own eyes, and it's not long before you have a total wipeout of that society. You cannot exist without laws. They are necessary to the preservation. And so God established these laws whereby the society might be preserved. God's people might be preserved in the land. So we pray. Father, we ask your help as we look at your word. We know that the law of the Lord is perfect, converting the soul. The testimonies of the Lord are pure, making wise the simple. They're more to be desired than gold, yea, much fine gold. And in keeping of them, there is great reward. Help us, Lord, to learn your ways. Help us, Lord, to walk in your paths. Help us to give heed to your word, that we might obey and continue in your truth. Lord, help us as we sort of wade through some of these more difficult areas of the scriptures. We might, O God, pay careful attention and not be quick to relegate the rules to another culture, another age, another society. But realize, Lord, that there are basic principles to which we must adhere if we're going to live a life that is pleasing to you, if we are to dwell peacefully and securely in the land which you have given to us. And so help us, Lord, to keep your statutes, to walk in your ways. In Jesus' name, amen. You guys are tremendous. You know, this is not easy stuff to go through. But it's necessary. We need to know the ways of the Lord. We need to study the law of God. We need to give heed thereto. And I want to commend you. Once we get out of Deuteronomy, the pace starts to quicken. Things start getting exciting again. You start dealing with events and happenings, and you know, a lot of excitement comes on into the scene. But just to wade through Deuteronomy, through Leviticus and these books, I mean, that's great. I commend you. But I know that my commendation is nothing. God will bless you, and that's what's important. The law of the Lord is perfect. Let's study the law of the Lord. Let's keep the law of the Lord. Let's walk in His statutes. Let's keep His ways. May the Lord be with you, and may the Lord watch over you and bless you in all of your ways. May He write His law upon the fleshly tablets of your heart. Thank God. Thank God that through Jesus Christ, the law which we read and dealt with tonight, how many of us would have already been wiped out? It condemned us. You know, in that society, A lot of us would have been stoned already. But thank God that Jesus Christ bore the curse of the law for us, being crucified. He's redeemed us from death, and we have life in Him. And may you enjoy that abundant life in Jesus this week as you walk in fellowship with Him.